Well, hello everybody. I guess it's time to start. I would like to welcome you all to the SACBAW meeting. It is nice to have you here. I'm Maynard Hanyuk, and I'm the moderator for today's meeting. The cost of the meeting and the lunch is $10. Place your money in the basket on each table, and will someone at each table check the amount in the basket? We would like to thank the University of Lethbridge for their support, which includes the distribution of meeting notices, and thanks also to Country Kitchen Catering for preparing the lunch and setting everything up for us. The format for the meeting is the presentation by the speaker for the first half hour, after which we will have a 30-minute break for lunch. Then we'll resume the meeting for a question period until 1:30. The topic for today's meeting is Conscientious Objection to Military Service and Citizenship, a Canadian Perspective. And the appalling death toll in the First World War and the need for a sense of equality of sacrifice on the home front led to Canada's first experience of overseas conscription. The backlash against enforced military service in Quebec was and has been historically seen as the great threat to the wartime vision of national unity. This has obscured the important role of conscientious objectors. The speaker argues that the experiences of these young men offer insight into evolving attitudes about the rights and responsibilities of citizenship during a key period of Canadian nation building. Our speaker for today is Dr. Amy Shaw. She is an assistant professor at the Department of History at the University of Lethbridge. Since arriving at the University of Lethbridge in 2005, she has taught courses in Canadian history, including Canada, War and Peace, Canada in Two World Wars, and Canadian Cultural History. Dr. Shaw's current research includes the activities of Canadian women during the First World War. She was educated in Ontario, and Dr. Shaw earned her university degrees from York, her bachelor's, McMaster, her master's, and her PhD in 2005 from Western Ontario. Her book, Crisis of Conscience, Conscientious Objection in Canada During the First World War, has been published by the University of British Columbia Press. Let us give Dr. Shaw a warm welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Thank you. This seems to me to be a very interesting and valuable organization, and it's an honor and pleasure to be able to share some of my work with you. Is it not loud enough? Closer? Like this? All right. Well, I was just thanking you for having me. Britain declared war on the Central Powers of Germany and Austria on August the 4th, 1914. Canada, as part of the British Empire, was automatically then at war too. Initially, Canada united behind the war effort. When Prime Minister Robert Borden summoned Parliament for a special war session on August the 18th, he told a cheering House of Commons, "As to our duty, we are all agreed. We stand shoulder to shoulder with Britain and the other British dominions in this quarrel." Canadians were united, and they were enthusiastic. Throughout the country, there were demonstrations of loyalty involving impromptu parades and singing and flag waving. Everyone seemed to be agreed on the righteousness of the cause. The suffragists dropped their criticisms of the government. The pacifist movement grew almost silent almost immediately. All the major churches supported the war. Mainstream churches in Canada, as in the other countries involved, tended to present the conflict as a holy war, acceptable because it was fought in the defense of Christian values. Even the Quebecois anti-imperialist Henri Bourassa initially supported Canadian participation, seeing the survival of Britain and France as vital to Canada. Most, especially English-speaking Canadians, viewed the war in sharp black and white terms as being clearly a battle of good versus evil. The war was promoted as being a battle for democracy against the autocracy and militarism of Germany. It was also seen as a battle for civilization. The enemy was often called the Hun, a reference to its supposed barbarity. Men were anxious to enlist. Most Canadians, like people in the other countries involved, believed that the war would be a short one, over by Christmas. If they didn't join up as quickly as possible, they feared they might miss out on what promised to be the greatest opportunity for personal heroism their generation would see. The Great War wasn't just seen as a great opportunity on an individual level. It seemed a key element in Canadian nation building, a chance for the country to prove itself. It was fighting on the world stage with the mature European powers. The war promised to give Canada respect among the rest of the world, not simply as part of the British Empire, but on its own account. The war also seemed like an important opportunity for a unifying experience within the country that seemed to many people to lack other elements of a shared history. And that's a big part of how we remember the war today. Vimy Ridge is probably the best example. In this battle, Canadians took an important piece of high ground that British and French troops had previously tried to take and failed. It was the first time Canadians attacked together, and they had this magnificent victory, gaining a reputation as elite troops. Vimy Ridge has been called the birthplace of Canadian nationalism. So this focus on nationalism and unity is what we remember when we think about the First World War. We don't remember a disorganized minority of young men who stood apart from that picture of unity, claiming that their allegiance to conscience outweighed their duty to go and fight when their country was at war. And that's a pity, because I think that looking at them can help us better understand certain aspects of Canadian society. They help us understand the evolution of ideas about freedom of religion and minority rights, for example. They're very interesting in terms of looking at ideas about appropriate manliness and how those ideas have changed over time. But what I want to focus on today is how they affected ideas about the rights and responsibilities of citizenship. Conscientious objection is at the core of the individual's relationship to the state, because it challenges what is generally seen as the most basic of civic obligations, the duty to defend one's country. At the same time, allowing refusal has become one of the hallmarks of democratic society. So it's an interesting case to examine. Take a little drink. Prime Minister Robert Borden had promised that there would be no conscription. But as casualties mounted, enlistment dried up, and the murmurs of discontent about the perception that some people and groups were sacrificing more than others grew louder, drafting men began to seem like a real and viable possibility. Conscription wasn't a novelty in Canada, although the Great War was the first large-scale use of it, and the first time Canadians were drafted for overseas service. Really, in spite of the existence of various militia acts since the time of New France, Canadians had little direct experience with military conscription. The volunteer militia had not been called out since the Northwest Rebellion of 1885, and the contingent sent to the South African War had been made up entirely of volunteers paid for and commanded by Britain. The tradition of militia service was also coupled in some quarters with a sense of conscription as un-British and a confidence in the efficacy of the voluntary system. Voluntarism was an important part for many people of their sense of Canada's national identity. The board administration introduced conscription under the 1917 Military Service Act. It included various grounds for exemption from conscription. You could ask for exemption on the grounds of ill health. You could argue that your job was essential to the prosecution of the war. Or you could argue that enlisting would cause serious financial hardship to those dependent upon you. The last grounds for exemption was that a conscript conscientiously objects to the undertaking of combatant service and is prohibited from so doing by the tenets and articles of faith in effect at the date of the passing of this act of any organized religious denomination existing and well recognized in Canada at such date and to which he in good faith belongs. This grounds for exemption was included partly in a spirit of liberal individuality. All of the Allied countries that enacted conscription legislation included a clause providing for exemption on conscientious grounds. But Canada's clause was very specific. Exemption was provided only to members of specific religious denominations. And this was because, according to the ideas about duty and responsibility that were such an important part of the First World War, the government had an obligation not only to the successful prosecution of the war, but also the obligation to respect the promises made to what are called the historic peace churches in Canada. These are the Mennonites, the Church of the Brethren, who are also called Tunkers or Dunkards, Dukobors, Hutterites, and the Society of Friends, or Quakers. Many of these people had emigrated to the country specifically based on promises that they would not be asked for military service. But members of these groups weren't the only ones who felt that their attitudes towards war placed them in the category of conscientious objectors. Members of smaller denominations, like the International Bible Students, who are today called Jehovah's Witnesses, Plymouth Brethren, Seventh-day Adventists, and Christadelphians, also objected, as did some members of mainstream Protestant and Catholic churches. They had a more difficult time. Not that all conscientious objectors didn't. Advocates of conscription promoted, among other things, its democratizing effects. One editorial in the Toronto Globe in 1917 discussed how conscription was a good policy because it democratized citizenship. The editor wrote, "The freedom of the individual is bound up with the defense of the nation. The small nations that seek freedom and independence and the untrammeled development of their civil life are forced to adopt a system of universal service. This is the case with Canada. In her search for honor and military strength and freedom, she finds it only in compulsory national service." The broad association of conscription with equality and democracy placed conscientious objectors in a most unfavorable light. The draft promised a parity of sacrifice and a recognition of group goals that many Canadians hoped would continue after the war. Objectors had chosen to differentiate themselves from that picture of unity, and it left them open to charges of selfishness, along with the more predictable allegations of cowardice. The widespread presentation of the war as being fought to preserve peace and Christian values also increased the difficulty of maintaining an ethical obligation to military service. Such an argument seemed to take the ground beneath the conscientious objector's feet. In these terms, military service was the ultimate expression of Christian sacrifice. It was incomprehensible to stand aside from a holy war for reasons of conscience. The London Free Press expressed this idea clearly in its apparent bafflement at one group's early efforts to claim conscientious objection. It said they seemed to be claiming exemption from religion on religious grounds. In this atmosphere, when conscientious objectors were disenfranchised under the Wartime Elections Act in 1917, it generated little protest. Just to give you a little context for how this came about, the Borden administration had been elected in 1911. Under normal circumstances, there ought to have been an election in 1915, but because of the war, the British government gave them special dispensation to continue, and nobody seemed to mind too much. But Borden didn't want to push it. With an election due and an incredibly divisive bill that he wanted to push through, conscription was terribly unpopular in Quebec and among various farming groups and organized labor. Robert Borden decided that the only way to get the necessary support was to try to form a coalition government. The election of what would be called the union government of conservatives and liberals together seemed as though it would be the best way to introduce compulsory military service. Before they called the election, though, the government introduced two acts. One was the Military Voters Act. It enfranchised all members of the armed forces, regardless of how long they had lived in Canada or how old they were. Furthermore, if a soldier didn't know or couldn't state his constituency, the government could use his vote in any riding it wanted. The other was the Wartime Elections Act. It gave the vote to Canadian women who were mothers, wives, sisters, or daughters of servicemen. And this is the first time that women were permitted to vote in federal elections. This is what the bill is most famous for. But the Wartime Elections Act also took the vote away from some people. Naturalized Canadians born in enemy countries who had settled in Canada after 1902 lost their right to vote, and conscientious objectors were also disenfranchised. This seems to be connected to the idea that voting was a prerogative of citizenship, and that citizenship was connected to the ability to defend one's country in time of war. Women who were closely related to soldiers were given the right to vote based upon their apparent stake in the military defense of their country. They were also, some critics charged, extended the franchise because they were deemed more likely to vote conservative. The Toronto Star was part of the widespread agreement with this decision. War service should be the basis of war franchise. The COs themselves, oh, sometimes I call conscientious objectors COs because conscientious can be hard to say and kind of cumbersome. I'm not talking about anybody's commanding officer. The COs themselves, the paper believed, would probably share its viewpoint. We find no fault with them for their beliefs. This is a free country, and they have been welcome to our shores, but they will, I am sure, deem it not unfair that those who are liable to do battle and all the sacrifices of the war should constitute the democracy which controls the destiny of the country in times of war. Voting was a prerogative of masculine adult citizenship. Removal of the franchise was not just a punishment for the objectors' dissenting behavior, but also a slur on their manhood. That the Wartime Elections Act enfranchised female relatives of soldiers made patent the sense that war service was the basis of war citizenship, and conscientious objectors were beyond the pale. The Union government won the election, and by the time the new parliament met on the 18th of March 1918, machinery for the enforcement of the Military Service Act had been set up under the control of the Department of Justice. To judge the validity of an individual's grounds for exemption from military service, and this isn't just on conscientious grounds, on any sort of claim for exemption, a series of local tribunals were set up throughout the country. If someone was unhappy with the decision of their local tribunal, there were a smaller series of appeal tribunals, and the final step was the Central Appeal Court, where the merits of the case were decided by Justice Lyman C. Duff of the Supreme Court of Canada. It's worth noting that if the military authorities were unhappy with the tribunal's decision, they could appeal it to the higher courts as well. So if you got exempted, but the military authorities didn't think that you deserved to be, they could appeal it as well. So both sides had that opportunity. Each tribunal had two members, one appointed by the county judge in the district concerned, and one selected by a joint committee of parliament. So they were trying to be fairly fair about this, but there were some problems. The local tribunals in general were made up of respected local figures who represented the more patriotic elements of society. A Toronto Globe article announcing the names of those appointed for Toronto and York County commented approvingly, "Almost all of these men are lawyers and well known in the profession and hold the respect of citizens generally. A number of them are represented at the front by sons or close relatives, which augurs well for the strict enforcement of the act." An impression of the elements of a typical tribunal and of attitudes towards those who claimed conscientious objection can be gleaned from a newspaper account of the tribunal of Arthur Bourgeois. He was a member of the International Bible Students Association. The reporter likened the proceedings to a battle. Bible quotations flew around Tribunal 362 Saturday afternoon like shrapnel around Passchendaele last week. The engagement, which opened with a few little preliminary skirmishes and raids Thursday and Friday, came to a general engagement Saturday afternoon, and it was long after union hours when it ceased. It was obvious who represented the Allies in the contest. Bourgeois wasn't downed without a lively battle. He spat and sputtered biblical quotations like a Bosch machine gun and gave the tribunal quite an argument before he was finally downed. In Bourgeois' hearing, the conscientious objector and the local tribunal share a Christian biblical discourse. Their arguments tended to focus on how to weigh and properly interpret biblical injunction. Arthur Bourgeois called upon many of the same biblical arguments to justify his pacifist stance, as did conscientious objectors of other religious backgrounds. He insisted that he was not of this world and said that he followed the biblical mandate to love one's neighbor. The members of Bourgeois' tribunal also followed a general pattern and responded using the same sort of language and evidence, offering instead the biblical injunction to obey laws and the precedent of Jesus driving the money changers from the temple as evidence that the use of force was biblically justified. The article reported that Bourgeois had been heard discussing conscription with Clay, another conscientious objector of the same ilk, for a year or so. They had been overheard to say that they would rather be shot than go to the front. But the judges did not interpret this as evidence of their sincerity. When it seemed that conscription might be a possibility, Bourgeois, like many international Bible students, had sworn an affidavit stressing his objection to undertaking military service. The affidavit was presented at the tribunal, but the members responded to it with annoyance. "This is getting a bit too thick," remarked Chairman Irwin as he examined the papers. "Here's a Class A man." He's healthy. This is what Class A means. "Here's a Class A man who claims that he is a conscientious objector presenting an affidavit setting forth his objections to military service on a printed form. That looks too much like an organized attempt to evade military service. It is astonishing that such things should be permitted. This affidavit looks as if it came from England." I'll try to explain that in a minute. The affidavit challenged accepted notions about the unworldliness of an appropriate conscientious objector, and seemed to present a dangerous level of organization. The somewhat cryptic reference to the document looking as if it came from England is most likely a reference to the No Conscription Fellowship that existed in England, which was an organization that provided support to conscientious objectors of all different religious and political affiliations, and was distrusted by most of the British government and tribunal system. Other reports show that the religious discourse that characterized Bourgeois' hearing was common. In one incident, somewhat amusing in the face of such a strong biblical discourse, a conscientious objector expressed surprise and disbelief when members told him about Jesus driving the moneylenders from the temple. They were apparently shocked at his ignorance, but could not find the passage themselves, so their assurances had to suffice until the man had the time to go back and look it up himself. Those who did not receive exemption from the tribunal were deemed to have enlisted, and upon their refusal to obey military orders, were subjected to a somewhat haphazard series of military arrests, court-martials, and detention. After some highly publicized mistreatment of conscientious objectors in Winnipeg, many were transferred to civilian prisons. They were generally sentenced to 2 years, though we see 10 years and quite a few life sentences. I haven't found anyone who actually served more than about 3 years, though. So they were generally transferred to civilian prisons later on, but still not everybody. And that's one of the themes we see, is the Canadian government was really quite clearly making up their policy as they went along. And a big part of what we see in terms of how conscientious objectors were treated after they were arrested was that they were probably just cowards or a particularly stubborn form of slacker. So how they were treated was in large part simply an effort to make their lives uncomfortable enough so that they would give in and obey military orders. Sometimes, though, the treatment of COs went beyond what most of contemporary Canadian society would countenance. Probably the most widely reported case of the alleged mistreatment of conscientious objectors involved two clerks from Winnipeg, both international Bible students, 32-year-old Robert Littler Clegg and 23-year-old Ralph Nash, and a Pentecostal, Charles Matheson. Both Clegg and Naish had been called up on the 18th of January, 1918, their requests for exemption from military service denied. The men suffered abuse at Minto Street Barracks in Winnipeg. For not obeying an order, they were held several times under an ice-cold shower until they either accepted military discipline or collapsed. Matheson broke down and agreed to obey orders. Later, testifying before a court of inquiry, he described the experience. The water was very cold, and as I stood under it, it got colder till it became icy cold. My whole body began to heave. When I would stand with my back to it, he, Provost Sergeant Simpson, would make me turn around and face it, and make me turn my face up to it. I was shading my face with my hand. He made me take my hand down. I was beginning to get dazed, and I was tumbling around. He asked me, "Will you give in now?" I said, "No." He put me in again. This went on 3 or 4 times. He said, "We will either break you or break your heart." I was put into my undershirt and things, and I was dragged away. According to his sworn affidavit that was published in the Winnipeg Free Press, Clegg's shower apparently lasted for about 15 minutes until he fell unconscious and had to be hospitalized. This is what started the court of inquiry. He charged that he was stripped of his clothes and subjected to a violent treatment of ice-cold water, and was then subjected to another cold shower treatment. I was in a semi-conscious state during the greater part of the second treatment, and when taken out, I was seated upon a cold stone slab, which caused me to lose control of myself and become absolutely incapable of any control of my limbs or muscles. While still wet and in a condition of complete nervous prostration and helplessness, I was dressed, dragged on the concrete floor upstairs through the drill hall to the place of detention. Subsequently, while unconscious, I was removed to the St. Boniface Hospital. The incident was corroborated by Private Paul Case, who reported that the soldiers of the barracks were highly incensed over such cruel treatment, and have questioned if even Germany can beat it. We, as men, regret that there are those so debased who would tolerate such treatment on human beings when it would be unlawful to mete out such treatment even to a dog. The commander of the depot battalion, Lieutenant Colonel Osler, played down the event, stating that the matter had been very much exaggerated. Another prominent officer, who is familiar with the case, compared the incident to schoolboy pranks or ragging. S.J. Dixon, one of the few voices of anti-war protest in Canadian politics of the time, brought the incident up in the Manitoba legislature and promised that he would follow the case very closely. In a letter to T.A. Kruger, the Federal Minister of Agriculture, he suggested that the Minister of Militia and Defense, Major General S.C. Mewburn, issue a general order about the treatment of conscientious objectors. Dixon wrote, "The day of torture should be passed. If there is no other way of dealing with these men, it would be more humane to shoot them at once than submit them to torture, which endangers their reason." The Manitoba Free Press published an editorial entitled "Stop It," cautioning Canada to avoid the serious mistakes in Britain's physical coercion of its conscientious objectors. The editor refused to believe the response of the officers about schoolboy pranks. "It is idle to pretend that in cases like this, the hazing is the result of spontaneous indignation by the companions of the recalcitrant. These things happen because somebody in authority is desirous that they should happen." A district court-martial was ordered to investigate Sergeant G.J. Simpson for his part in the hazing, but the court found the charges to be absolutely groundless, and he was acquitted. Despite some effort, civil charges were never laid. The court of inquiry took no action regarding the treatment of conscientious objectors, beyond ordering that in the future, objectors who refused military orders were to be sent to civil prisons. Major General Mewburn supported his subordinates at Minto Barracks and concluded that the affair had been blown out of proportion. Clegg, Naish, and another Bible student, Frank Wainwright, were convicted by district court martials, sentenced to 2 years at Stony Mountain Penitentiary, and later shipped overseas to England. There's a larger group of men shipped overseas to England throughout the war. Some men were shipped overseas because disobeying a military order at the front, which was deemed to include England, was grounds for being shot. So this was intended to scare them into giving up their objection. Nobody did. And nobody got shot either, in case you're worried. They were subjected to some very harsh treatment, which I don't have time to address today because we do eventually need to eat our lunch. And I also want to have a little bit more time to talk about the mindset of the conscientious objector and of wider Canadian reaction to them. In describing the brutal treatment, Clegg's statement also makes clear the lengths to which he took his refusal to submit to military authority, including refusing to dry himself when wet and freezing because he'd been ordered to do so. Probably because of a stronger support structure, absolutist conscientious objectors like Clegg seem to have been more common in Britain than in Canada, but they occasioned the same baffled, frustrated, and occasionally violent response in both countries. When discussing the hazing incident, under the registrar, under the Military Service Act, E.R. Chapman, said that the men were adopting a most unreasonable attitude. Had they simply shown reason and explained their objections to actually killing a man, surely some other form of work could be found. The best among the conscientious objectors meet the situation halfway. This was a common attitude, that conscientious objectors who are willing to take on some form of non-combatant service seem to accept the same ideas about civil duty and responsibility as their compatriots. Absolutists were seen as merely stubborn, rather than as men unwilling to negotiate their principles. The case of David Wells also drew wide attention. Wells had refused to report when called up for service, and he'd been charged with desertion. His 2-year sentence was intended as something of a deterrent for others considering the same course of action. Captain Goddard, an assistant provost marshal who conducted the prosecution at his tribunal, referred to Wells, a 24-year-old Pentecostal who worked as a teamster, and a Bible student, Charles H. Edwards, as religious fanatics who attempted to hide behind their religion. The men were equally adamant in their defiance. When asked to plead, Wells responded, "I plead guilty before man, but not before God." While his rather cocky absolutism earned him a brief newspaper mention, he drew wide notice when he died in Selkirk Asylum a month later. The Manitoba Free Press summarized, "Wells became a raving lunatic 4 days after being taken to the penitentiary on January 24th. On February 11th, he was removed to the Selkirk Asylum and died on February 18th. There was a great deal of publicity and a great deal of argument over who was to blame. Members of the Pentecostal mission to which Wells belonged claimed that they'd been denied admission when trying to visit him at Stony Mountain Prison and that he'd entered it a healthy man. The Justice Department reported that Wells was a manic depressive who had been overcome by shame. Members of his church seem to have blamed his death on intolerable social pressure more than on any sort of ill treatment while in prison. The Manitoba Free Press spoke to his pastor. Reverend Mr. Sweet stated that the death certificate, when he saw it, hinted that probably Wells was wrong mentally for some time. This, according to Mr. Sweet, is not borne out by facts. What is the use of a government doing men to death in this fashion, he said. He was sentenced by a judge who knew absolutely nothing about his private life and who was influenced by what he was told by other people. The reference to Wells' private life apparently refers to the fact that Wells was supporting his mother in England, and that he had 2 brothers in the British Army and a father who had served a long career in the Navy. It is instructive to compare this situation to that of the absolutists in the Minto Barracks case. Charles Matheson's mother made a statement to the Manitoba Free Press supporting her son's position. "I would rather have my boy put up against that wall and shot than he have to go and fight. He is standing up for his Lord, and he will keep on doing so. These boys have suffered for their Lord, and they will still suffer, and then they will not fight." Matheson had support at home for his absolutist stance. Wells did not. It's impossible to know David Wells' mental state when entering prison. The speed of his decline is certainly shocking, whatever his mental health. But his stance was a very lonely and unpopular one. And it seems that the confidence with which he faced his tribunal could not be sustained. When Wells' physical and psychological isolation from his family was apparently mitigated by the support of his church, guilt and worry over his mother's support probably added to the strain. One conscientious objector in Britain describes the pressure and isolation he and his fellow pacifist faced. "No normal person likes the prospect of being sentenced to death, but the prospect caused infinitely less anxiety and mental anguish to the COs than the fact that they found themselves up against the war fever, not only of their countrymen at large, but of their neighbors and even some members of their own family. The lack of an organization along the lines of the British NCF meant that in Canada, COs, unless they had some church support, were isolated from each other as well. The specifically biblical terms of reference used by the COs might seem to distance them from 21st century realities, even among their co-religionists. It's not quite so simple. Debates about obedience to authority and the place of dissent in political culture still have resonance today. The search for balance between the rights and obligations of individuals and minority groups against those of the democratic majority is an ongoing one. In spite of the ostensible cynicism of a violent and secular century, governments around the world still speak of war in religious terms and of pacifists and war resistors as lack in their civic and religious duties. In such a climate, the experiences of these citizens who disagreed with their government and the majority of mainstream society about a matter of conscience remains as relevant as ever. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Shaw. We will now break for lunch.